Robin interrupts before I can speak.
Rick, I'm not letting Bronwyn answer any questions until you tell me why she's here. If you have something to show or tell us, please get to that first.
I do,
Detective Mendoza says, rotating the laptop so it faces me.
One of your classmates alerted us to a post that ran 18 months ago, Bronwyn. Does this look familiar?
My mother moves her chair next to me as Robin leans over my shoulder. I focus my eyes on the screen, but I already know what I'm about to read. I've worried for weeks that it might come up. So maybe I should have said something, but it's too late now. Newsflash, LV's end-of-the-year party isn't a charity event, just so we're clear. You'd be excused for thinking so, though, with frosh attendance at an all-time high. Regular readers, and if you're not one, what the hell is wrong with you? No, I try to cut the kids some slack. Children are our future and all that. But let me do a little PSA for one new, and fleeting, I'm gonna guess, arrival to the social scene. M.R., who doesn't seem to realize S.C. is out of her league. He's not in the market for a puppy, kid. Stop with the following. It's pathetic. And guys, don't give me that poor little thing had cancer crap. Not anymore. M can put on her big girl panties like anyone else and learn a few basic rules. 1. Varsity basketball players with cheerleader girlfriends are off the market. I shouldn't have to explain this, but apparently I do. 2. Two beers are too many when you're a lightweight, because it leads to 3. The worst display of awkward kitchen table dancing I've ever seen. Seriously, M, never again. 4. If that one beer makes you throw up, try not to do it in your host's washing machine. That's just rude. Let's card at the door from now on, okay, LV? At first, it's funny, but then it's just sad. I stay still in my chair and try to keep my face impassive. I remember that post like it was yesterday. How Maeve, who'd been giddy from her first crush and her first party, even though neither had gone exactly as planned, folded into herself after she read Simon's post and refused to go out again. I remember all the impotent rage I'd felt, that Simon was so casually cruel, just because he could be. Because he had a willing audience that ate it up. And I hated him for it. I can't look at my mother, who has no idea any of this happened, so I focus on Robin. If she's surprised or concerned, she doesn't show it.
All right, I've read it. Tell me what you think the significance of this is, Rick. I'd like to hear that from Bronwyn.
No.
Robin's voice cracks like a velvet whip, soft but unyielding.
Explain why we're here. This post appears to be written about Bronwyn's sister, Maeve.
What makes you think that? Robin asks.
My mother chokes out a furious, disbelieving laugh, and I finally sneak a look at her. Her face is bright red, her eyes burning. Her voice shakes when she speaks.
Is this for real? You bring us here to show us this horrible post written by a, I have to say, a boy who quite clearly had issues. And for what? What are you hoping to accomplish exactly?
Detective Mendoza tilts his head in her direction.
I'm sure this is difficult to read, Mrs. Rojas, but between the initials and the cancer diagnosis, it's obvious Simon was writing about your younger daughter. There's no other current or past student at Bayview High who fits that profile.
He turns toward me.
This must have been humiliating for your sister, Bronwyn. And from what other kids at school have told us recently, she's never really participated in social activities since then. Did that make you resent Simon?
My mother opens her mouth to speak. But Robin puts a hand on her arm and cuts her off.
Bronwyn has no comment.
Detective Mendoza's eyes gleam, and he looks as though he can barely restrain himself from grinning.
Oh, but she does. Or she did, anyway. Simon unpublished the blog more than a year ago, but all the posts and comments are still recorded on the back end.
He pulls the laptop back and presses a few keys, then spins it toward us with a new window open.
You have to give your email address to leave a comment. This is yours, right, Bronwyn?
Anybody can leave another person's email address, Robin says quickly. Then she leans over my shoulder again and reads what I wrote at the end of sophomore year. Fuck off and die, Simon.
Addie, Monday, October 15th, 4:15 p.m. The road from my house to Jake's is a pretty smooth ride until I turn onto Clarendon Street. It's a major intersection, and I have to get to the far left without the help of a bike lane. When I first started riding again, I used to head for the sidewalk and cross with the light, but now I whiz across three lanes of traffic like a pro. I cruise into Jake's driveway and push the kickstand down as I dismount, pulling off my helmet and looping it across my handlebars. I run a hand through my hair as I approach the house, but it's a pointless gesture. I've gotten used to the cut, and sometimes I even like it, but short of growing it a foot and a half overnight, there's nothing I can do to improve it in Jake's eyes. I ring the doorbell and step back, uncertainty humming through my veins. I don't know why I'm here or what I'm hoping for. The door clicks and Jake pulls it open. He looks the same as ever, tousled-haired and blue-eyed, in a perfectly fitted T-shirt that shows off his football season workouts to great effect. Hey, come in. I instinctively turn toward the basement, but that's not where we're headed. Instead, Jake leads me into the formal living room, where I've spent less than an hour total since I started dating Jake more than 3 years ago. I lower myself onto his parents' leather sofa, and my still-sweaty legs stick to it almost immediately. Who decided leather furniture was a good idea? When he sits down across from me, his mouth sets in such a hard line that I can tell this won't be a reconciliation conversation. I wait for crushing disappointment to hit, but it doesn't.
So you ride a bike now? He asks.
Of all the conversations we could have, I'm not sure why he's starting with this one. I don't have a car, I remind him. And you used to drive me everywhere. He leans forward with his elbows on his knees. Such a familiar gesture, but I almost expect him to start chatting about football season like he would have a month ago.
How's the investigation going? Cooper never talks about it anymore. You guys still all under the gun or what?
I don't want to talk about the investigation. The police have questioned me a couple of times over the past week, always finding new ways to ask me about the missing EpiPens in the nurse's office. My lawyer tells me the repetitive questioning means the investigation's going nowhere. Not that I'm their main suspect. It's none of Jake's business, though. So I tell him a stupid, made-up story about how the four of us saw Detective Wheeler eating an entire plateful of donuts in an interrogation room. Jake rolls his eyes when I'm done.
So basically, they're getting nowhere.
Bronwyn's sister thinks people should be looking at Simon more, I say.
Why Simon? He's dead for crying out loud.
Because it might turn up suspects the police haven't thought of yet. Other people who had a reason for wanting Simon out of the picture. Jake blows out an annoyed sigh and flings an arm across the back of his chair.
Blame the victim, you mean? What happened to Simon wasn't his fault. If people didn't pull such sneaky bullshit moves, about that wouldn't even have existed.
He narrowed his eyes at me.
You know that better than anyone.
Still doesn't make him a great guy, I counter, with a stubbornness that surprises me. About that hurt a lot of people. I don't understand why he kept it up for so long. Did he like people being afraid of him? I mean, you were friends with him growing up, right? Was he always that way?
Is that why you stopped hanging out? Are you doing Bronwyn's investigative work for her now?
Is he sneering at me?
I'm as curious as she is. Simon's kind of a central figure in my life now.
He snorts.
I didn't invite you here to argue with me.
I stare at him, searching for something familiar in his face.
I'm not arguing. We are having a conversation.
But even as I say it, I try to remember the last time I talked to Jake and didn't agree 100% with whatever he said. I can't come up with a thing. I reach up and play with the back of my earring, pulling it until it almost comes off and then sliding it on again. It's a nervous habit I've developed, now that I don't have hair to wind around my fingers. So why did you invite me here? His lips curl as his eyes flick away from me.
Leftover concern, I guess. Plus, I deserve to know what's happening. I keep getting calls from reporters, and I'm sick of it.
He sounds like he's waiting for an apology. But I've already given enough of those. So am I. He doesn't say anything. And as silence falls, I'm acutely aware of how loud the clock over his fireplace is. I count 63 ticks before I ask, "Will you ever be able to forgive me?" I'm not even sure what kind of forgiveness I want anymore. It's hard to imagine going back to being Jake's girlfriend, but it would be nice if he stopped hating me. His nostrils flare, and his mouth pulls into a bitter twist.
How could I? You cheated on me and lied about it, Addie. You're not who I thought you were.
I'm starting to think that's a good thing. I'm not going to make excuses, Jake. I screwed up, but not because I didn't care about you. I guess I never thought I was worthy of you. Then I proved it. His cold gaze doesn't waver.
Don't play the poor me card, Addie. You knew what you were doing.
Okay. All of a sudden, I feel like I did when Detective Wheeler first interrogated me. I don't have to talk to you. Jake might be getting satisfaction from picking at the scab of our relationship, but I'm not. I stand up, my skin making a faint peeling sound as it unsticks from the sofa. I'm sure I've left two thigh-shaped imprints behind. Gross. But who cares anymore? I guess I'll see you around. I let myself out and climb onto my bike, putting on my helmet. As soon as it's clipped tight, I push up the kickstand, and I'm pedaling hard down Jake's driveway. Once my heart finds a comfortable pounding rhythm, I remember how it almost beat out of my chest when I confessed to cheating on Jake. I'd never felt so trapped in my life. I thought I'd feel the same way in his living room today, waiting for him to tell me again I'm not good enough. But I didn't. And I don't. For the first time in a long time, I feel free.
Cooper. Monday, October 15th, 4:20 p.m. My life isn't mine anymore. It's been taken over by a media circus. There aren't reporters in front of my house every day, but it's a common enough occurrence that my stomach hurts whenever I get close to home. I try not to go online more than I have to. I used to dream about my name being a trending search on Google, but for pitching a no-hitter in the World Series, not for possibly killing a guy with peanut oil. Everyone says, just keep your head down. I've been trying, but once you're under a microscope, nothing slips by people. Last Friday at school, I got out of my car the same time Addie got out of her sister's. The breeze ruffling her short hair. We were both wearing sunglasses, a pointless attempt at blending in, and gave each other our usual tight-lipped, still can't believe this is happening smile. We hadn't gone more than a few steps before we saw Nate stride over to Bronwyn's car and open the door, being all exaggeratedly polite about it. He smirked as she got out, and she gave him a look that made Addie and me exchange glances behind our shades. The four of us ended up almost in a line, walking toward the back entrance. The whole thing barely took a minute, just enough time for one of our classmates to record a phone video that wound up on TMZ that night. They ran it in slow-mo with the song Kids by MGMT playing in the background, like we're some kind of hip high school murder club without a care in the world. The thing went viral within a day. That might be the weirdest thing about all this. Plenty of people hate us and want us in jail, but there are just as many, if not more, who love us. All of a sudden, I have a Facebook fan page with over 50,000 likes, mostly girls, according to my brother. The attention slows sometimes, but it never really stops. I thought I'd avoided it tonight when I left my house to meet Luis at the gym, but as soon as I arrive, a pretty, dark-haired woman with a face full of makeup hurries toward me. My heart sinks because I'm familiar with her type. I've been followed again.
Cooper, do you have a few minutes?
Liz Rosen with Channel 7 News. I'd love your perspective on all this. A lot of people are rooting for you. I don't answer, brushing past her through the gym's entrance. She clicks after me in her high heels, a cameraman trailing in her wake, but the guy at the front desk stops them both. I've been going there for years, and they've been pretty cool through all this. I disappear down the hall while he argues with her that no, she can't buy a membership on the spot. Luis and I bench press for a while, but I'm preoccupied with what's waiting outside for me when we're done. We don't talk about it, but in the locker room afterward he says, "Give me your shirt and keys." "What?" "I'll be you. Head out of here in your cap and sunglasses. They won't know the difference. Take my car and get the hell out of here. Go home, go out, whatever. We can swap cars again at school tomorrow." I'm about to tell him that'll never work. His hair's a lot darker than mine, and he's at least a shade tanner. Then again, with a long-sleeved shirt and a cap on, it might not matter. Worth a shot, anyway. So I hover in the hallway as Luis strides out the front door in my clothes to the bright lights of cameras. My baseball cap sits low on his forehead, and his hand shields his face as he climbs into my Jeep. He peels out of the parking lot, and a couple of vans follow. I put on Luis's hat and sunglasses, then get into his Honda and fling my gym bag across the seat. It takes a few tries to start the engine, but once it roars, I pull out of the parking lot and take back roads until I'm on the highway towards San Diego. When I'm downtown, I circle for half an hour, still paranoid someone's following me. Eventually, I make my way to the North Park neighborhood, pulling in front of an old factory that was renovated into condos last year. The neighborhood's trendy, with lots of well-dressed kids a little older than me filling the sidewalk. A pretty girl in a flowered dress almost doubles over laughing at something the guy next to her says. She clutches his arm as they pass Luis's car without looking my way, and I feel a bone-deep sense of loss. I was like them a few weeks ago, and now I'm not. I shouldn't be here. What if someone recognizes me? I pull a key out of my gym bag and wait for a break in the sidewalk crowds. I'm out of Luis's car and in the front door so fast I don't think anyone could have seen me. I duck into the elevator and take it to the top floor, letting out a sigh of relief when it doesn't stop once. The hallway echoes with empty silence. All the hipsters who live here must be out for the afternoon. Except one, I hope. When I knock, I only half expect an answer. I never called or texted to say I was coming. But the door cracks open, and a pair of startled green eyes meet mine.
"Hey."
Chris steps aside to let me in.
"What are you doing here?"
"Had to get out of my house." I close the door behind me and take off my hat and sunglasses, tossing them on an entry table. I feel silly, like a kid who's been caught playing spy. Except people are following me. Just not right this second. "Plus, I guess we should talk about the whole signing thing, huh?"
"Later."
Chris hesitates a fraction of a second, then leans forward and pulls me roughly toward him, pressing his lips against mine. I close my eyes, and the world around me fades, like it always does, when I slide my hands into his hair and kiss him back.
Part 3. Truth or Dare. Chapter 19.
Nate. Monday, October 15th, 4:30 p.m. My mother's upstairs, trying to have a conversation with my father. Good luck with that. I'm on our couch with my burner phone in hand, wondering what I can text to Bronwyn to keep her from hating me. Not sure "sorry I lied about my mom being dead" is going to cut it. It's not like I wanted her dead, but I thought she probably was or would be soon. And it was easier than saying or thinking the truth. She's a coke addict who ran off to some commune in Oregon and hasn't talked to me since. So when people started asking where my mother was, I lied. By the time it hit me how fucked up a response that was, it was too late to take it back. Nobody's ever really cared anyway. Most of the people I know don't pay attention to what I say or do, as long as I keep the drugs coming. Except Officer Lopez, and now Bronwyn. I thought about telling her a few times late at night while we were talking, but I could never figure out how to start the conversation. I still can't. I put my phone away. The stairs creak as my mother comes down, brushing her hands on the front of her pants. Your father's not in any shape to talk right now. Shocking, I mutter. She looks both older and younger than she used to. Her hair is a lot grayer and shorter, but her face isn't so ragged and drawn. She's heavier, which I guess is good. Means she's eating anyway. She crosses over to Stan's terrarium and gives me a small, nervous smile. Nice to see Stan still around. Not much has changed since we last saw you, I say, putting my feet on the coffee table in front of me. Same bored lizard, same drunk dad, same falling apart house. Except now I'm being investigated for murder. Maybe you heard about that. Nathaniel. My mother sits in the armchair and clasps her hands in front of her. Her nails are as bitten off as ever. I don't even know where to start. I've been sober for almost 3 months, and I've wanted to contact you every single second. But I was so afraid I wasn't strong enough yet, and I'd let you down again. Then I saw the news. I've been coming by the last few days, but you're never home. I gesture at the cracked walls and sagging ceiling. Will you be? Her face crumples. I'm sorry, Nathaniel. I hoped your father would step up. You hoped. Solid parenting plan. At least he's here. It's a low blow, and not a ringing endorsement since the guy barely moves, but I feel entitled to it. My mother nods her head jerkily while cracking her knuckles. God, I forgot she did that. It's fucking annoying. I know. I have no right to criticize. I don't expect you to forgive me, or believe you'll get anything better than what you're used to from me. But I'm finally on meds that work and don't make me sick with anxiety. It's the only reason I could finish rehab this time. I have a whole team of doctors in Oregon who've been helping me stay sober. Must be nice to have a team. It's more than I deserve, I know. Her downcast eyes and humble tone are pissing me off. But I'm pretty sure anything she did would piss me off right now. I get to my feet. This has been great, but I need to be somewhere. You can let yourself out, right? Unless you want to hang with Dad. Sometimes he wakes up around 10. Oh, crap. Now she's crying.
I'm sorry, Nathaniel. You deserve so much better than the two of us. My God, just look at you. I can't believe how handsome you've gotten. And you're smarter than both your parents put together. You always were. You should be living in one of those big houses in Bayview Hills, not taking care of this dump on your own.
Whatever, Mom. It's all good. Nice to see you. Send me a postcard from Oregon sometime.
Nathaniel, please.
She stands and tugs at my arm. Her hands look 20 years older than the rest of her. Soft and wrinkled, covered with brown spots and scars.
I want to do something to help you. Anything.
I'm staying in the Motel 6 on Bay Road.
Could I take you out to dinner tomorrow? Once you've had some time to process all this?
Process this? Christ. What kind of rehab speak is she spewing? I don't know. Leave a number. I'll call you. Maybe.
Okay.
She's nodding like a puppet again, and I'm going to lose it if I don't get away from her soon.
Nathaniel, was that Bronwyn Rojas I saw earlier?
Yeah, I say. And she smiles. Why?
It's just, well, if that's who you're with, we can't have messed you up too badly.
I'm not with Bronwyn. We're murder co-suspects, remember? I say, and let the door slam behind me. Which is self-defeating, because when it comes off its hinges again, I'm the one who'll have to fix it. Once I'm outside, I don't know where to go. I get on my bike and head for downtown San Diego, then change my mind and get on I-15 North, and just keep riding. Stopping after an hour to fill up my tank. I pull out my burner phone while I'm doing it and check messages. Nothing. I should call Bronwyn, see how things went at the police station. She's gotta be fine, though. She has that expensive lawyer along with parents who are like guard dogs between her and people trying to mess with her. And anyway, what the hell would I say? I put my phone away. I ride for almost 3 hours until I hit wide desert roads dotted with scrubby bushes. Even though it's getting late, it's hotter here near the Mojave Desert, and I stop to take off my jacket as I cruise closer to Joshua Tree. The only vacation I ever went on with my parents was a camping trip here when I was 9 years old. I spent the whole time waiting for something bad to happen, for our ancient car to break down, for my mother to start screaming or crying, for my dad to go still and silent, like he always did when we got to be too much for him to take. It was almost normal, though. They were as tense with each other as ever, but kept the arguing to a minimum. My mother was on good behavior. Maybe because she had a thing for those short, twisted trees that were everywhere. The first 7 years of the Joshua Tree's life, it's just a vertical stem, no branches. She told me while we were hiking. It takes years before it blooms, and every branching stem stops growing after it blossoms. So you've got this complex system of dead areas and new growth. I used to think about that sometimes, when I wondered what parts of her might still be alive. It's past midnight by the time I get back to Bayview. I thought about getting on I-15 and riding through the night, as far as I could go until I dropped from exhaustion. Let my parents have whatever fucked up reunion they're about to get into on their own. Let the Bayview police come find me if they ever want to talk to me again. But that's what my mother would do. So in the end, I came back, checked my phones, and followed up on the only text I had. A party at Chad Posner's house. When I get there, Posner's nowhere to be found. I end up in his kitchen, nursing a beer and listening to two girls go on and on about a TV show I've never seen. It's boring and doesn't take my mind off my mother's sudden reappearance or Bronwyn's police summons. One of the girls starts to giggle.
I know you,
she says, poking me in the side. She giggles harder and flattens her palm against my stomach.
You were on Mikhail Powers' Investigates, weren't you? One of the kids who maybe killed that guy?
She's half drunk and staggers as she leans closer. She looks like a lot of the girls I meet at Posner's parties. Pretty, in a forgettable way. Oh, my God, Mallory, her friend says. That's so rude. Not me, I say. I just look like him.
Liar.
Mallory tries to poke me again, but I step out of reach.
Well, I don't think you did it. Neither does Brianna. Right, Bri?
Her friend nods.
We think it was the girl with the glasses. She looks like a stuck-up bitch.
My hand tightens around my beer bottle. I told you that's not me, so you can drop it.
Sorry,
Mallory slurs, tilting her head and shaking bangs out of her eyes.
Don't be such a grouch. I bet I can cheer you up.
She slides a hand into her pocket and pulls out a crumpled baggie filled with tiny squares.
Want to go upstairs with us and trip for a while?
I hesitate. I'd do almost anything to get out of my head right now. It's the McCauley family way, and everybody already thinks I'm that guy. Almost everybody. Can't, I say, pulling out my burner phone and starting to shoulder my way through the crowd. It buzzes before I get outside. When I look at the screen and see Bronwyn's number, even though she's the only one who ever calls me on this phone, I feel a massive sense of relief. Like I've been freezing and someone wrapped a blanket around me.
Hey,
Bronwyn says when I pick up. Her voice is far away, quiet.
Can we talk?
Bronwyn, Tuesday, October 16th, 12:30 a.m. I'm nervous about sneaking Nate into the house. My parents are already furious with me for not telling them about Simon's blog post, both now and back when it actually happened. We got out of the police station without much trouble, though. Robin gave this haughty speech that was all, "Stop wasting our time with meaningless speculation that you can't prove, and that wouldn't be actionable even if you did." I guess she was right, because here I am. Although I'm grounded until, as my mother says, I stop undermining my future by not being transparent. "You couldn't have hacked into Simon's old blog while you were at it," I muttered to Maeve before she went to bed. She looked genuinely chagrined. "He took it down so long ago. I didn't think it even existed anymore. And I never knew you wrote that comment. It wasn't posted." She shook her head at me with a sort of exasperated fondness. "You were always more upset about that than I was, Bronwyn." Maybe she's right. It occurred to me, as I lay in my dark room, debating whether I should call Nate, that I've spent years thinking Maeve was a lot more fragile than she actually is. Now, I'm downstairs in our media room, and when I get a text from Nate that he's at the house, I open the basement door and stick my head outside. "Over here," I call softly, and a shadowy figure comes around the corner next to our bulkhead. I retreat back into the basement, leaving the door open for Nate to follow me. He comes in wearing a leather jacket over a torn, rumpled T-shirt, his hair falling sweaty across his forehead from the helmet. I don't say anything until I've led him into the media room and closed the door behind us. My parents are three floors away and asleep, but the added bonus of a soundproof room can't be overstated at a time like this. So, I sit in one corner of the couch, knees bent and arms crossed over my legs like a barrier. Nate takes off his jacket and tosses it on the floor, lowering himself on the opposite end. When he meets my eyes, his are clouded with so much misery that I almost forget to be upset. "How'd it go at the police station?" he asks. "Fine, but that's not what I want to talk about." He drops his eyes.
"I know."
Silence stretches between us, and I want to fill it with a dozen questions, but I don't.
"You must think I'm an asshole,"
he says finally, still staring at the floor.
"And a liar."
"Why didn't you tell me?" Nate exhales a slow breath and shakes his head.
"I wanted to. I thought about it. I didn't know how to start. Thing is, it was this lie I told because it was easier than the truth, and because I half believed it anyway. I didn't think she'd ever come back. Then, once you say something like that, how do you unsay it? You look like a fucking psycho at that point."
He raises his eyes again, locking on mine with sudden intensity.
"I'm not, though. I haven't lied to you about anything else. I'm not dealing drugs anymore, and I didn't do anything to Simon. I don't blame you if you don't believe me, but I swear to God it's true."
Another long silence descends while I try to gather my thoughts. I should be angrier, probably. I should demand proof of his trustworthiness, even though I have no idea what that would look like. I should ask lots of pointed questions designed to ferret out whatever other lies he's told me. But the thing is, I do believe him. I won't pretend I know Nate inside and out after a few weeks. But I know what it's like to tell yourself a lie so often that it becomes the truth. I did it, and I haven't had to muddle through life almost completely on my own. And I've never thought he had it in him to kill Simon. "Tell me about your mom, for real, okay?" I ask. And he does. We talk for over an hour. But after the first 15 minutes or so, we're mainly covering old ground. I start feeling stiff from sitting so long and lift my arms over my head in a stretch.
"Tired?"
Nate asks, moving closer. I wonder if he's noticed that I've been staring at his mouth for the past 10 minutes. "Not really." He reaches out and pulls my legs over his lap, tracing a circle on my left knee with his thumb. My legs tremble, and I press them together to make it stop. His eyes flick toward mine, then down.
"My mother thought you were my girlfriend."
Maybe if I do something with my hands, I can manage to hold still. I reach up and tangle my fingers into the hair on the nape of his neck, smoothing the soft waves against his warm skin. "Well, I mean, is that out of the question?"
"Oh, God, I actually said it.
What if it is?" Nate's hand moves down my leg, almost absently, like he has no idea he's turning my entire body into jelly.
"You want a drug-dealing murder suspect who lied about his not-dead mother as your boyfriend?"
"Former drug dealer," I correct, and I'm not in a position to judge. He looks up with a half-smile, but his eyes are wary.
"I don't know how to be with somebody like you, Bronwyn."
He must see my face fall, because he quickly adds,
"I'm not saying I don't want to.
I'm saying I think I'd screw it up. I've only ever been, you know, casual about this kind of thing. I don't know. I pull my hands back and twist them in my lap, watching my pulse jump under the thin skin of my wrist. Are you casual now? With somebody else? No, Nate says. I was, when you and I first started talking. But not since then. Well, I'm quiet for a few seconds, weighing whether I'm about to make a giant mistake. Probably, but I plow ahead anyway. I'd like to try, if you want to. Not because we're thrown together in this weird situation, and I think you're hot, although I do, but because you're smart and funny, and you do the right thing more often than you give yourself credit for. I like your horrible taste in movies, and the way you never sugarcoat anything, and the fact that you have an actual lizard. I'd be proud to be your girlfriend. Even in a non-official capacity, while we're, you know, being investigated for murder. Plus, I can't go more than a few minutes without wanting to kiss you, so there's that. Nate doesn't reply at first, and I worry I've blown it. Maybe that was too much information. But he's still running his hand down my leg, and finally he says, "You're doing better than me. I never stop thinking about kissing you." He takes off my glasses and folds them, putting them on the side table next to the couch. His hand on my face is feather light as he leans in close and pulls my mouth toward his. I hold my breath as our lips connect, and the soft pressure sends a warm ache humming through my veins. It's sweet and tender, different from the hot, needy kiss at Marshall's Peak, but it still makes me dizzy. I'm shaking all over and press my hands against his chest to try to get that under control, feeling a hard plane of muscle through his thin shirt. Not helping. My lips part in a sigh that turns into a small moan. When Nate slides his tongue to meet mine, our kisses grow deeper and more intense, our bodies so tangled I can't tell where mine stops and his starts. I feel like I'm falling, floating, flying, all at once. We kiss until my lips are sore and my skin sparks like I've been lit by a fuse. Nate's hands are surprisingly PG. He touches my hair and face a lot, and eventually he slides a hand under my shirt and runs it over my back and, oh God, I might have whimpered. His fingers dip into the waistband of my shorts, and a shiver goes through me. But he stops there. The insecure side of me wonders if he's not as attracted to me as I am to him, or as he is to other girls. Except I've been pressed against him for half an hour, and I know that's not it. He pulls back and looks at me, his thick, dark lashes sweeping low. God, his eyes. They're ridiculous.
"I keep picturing your father walking in," he murmurs. "He kinda scares me."
I sigh, because, truth be told, that's been in the back of my mind, too. Even though there's barely a 5% chance, it's still too much. Nate runs a finger over my lips.
"Her mouth is so red. We should take a break before I do permanent damage. Plus, I need to, calm down a little."
He kisses my cheek and reaches for his jacket on the floor. My heart drops. "Are you leaving?"
"No,"
He takes his phone out of his pocket and pulls up Netflix, then hands me my glasses. We can finally finish watching Ringu.
Damn it, I thought you'd forgotten about that.
My disappointment's fake this time, though.
Come on, this is perfect.
Nate stretches on the couch, and I curl next to him with my head on his shoulder as he props his iPhone in the crook of his arm.
We'll use my phone instead of that 60-inch monster on your wall. You can't be scared of anything on such a tiny screen.
Honestly, I don't care what we do. I just want to stay wrapped around him for as long as possible, fighting sleep and forgetting about the rest of the world. Chapter 20.
Cooper. Tuesday, October 16th, 5:45 p.m. Pass the milk, would you, Cooperstown? Pop jerks his chin at me during dinner, his eyes drifting toward the muted television in our living room, where college football scores scroll along the bottom of the screen. So, what did you do with your night off? He thinks it's hilarious that Luis posed as me after the gym yesterday. I hand over the carton and picture myself answering his question honestly. Hung out with Chris, the guy I'm in love with. Yeah, Pop, I said guy. No, Pop, I'm not kidding. He's a pre-med freshman at UCSD who does modeling on the side. Total catch. You'd like him. And then Pop's head explodes. That's how it always ends in my imagination. Just drove around for a while, I say instead. I'm not ashamed of Chris. I'm not. But it's complicated. Thing is, I didn't realize I could feel that way about a guy till I met him. I mean, yeah, I suspected, since I was 11 or so. But I buried those thoughts as far down as I could because I'm a southern jock shooting for an MLB career and that's not how we're supposed to be wired. I really did believe that for most of my life. I've always had a girlfriend, but it was never hard to hold off till marriage like I was raised. I only recently understood that was more of an excuse than a deeply held moral belief. I've been lying to Keely for months. But I did tell her the truth about Chris. I met him through baseball, although he doesn't play. He's friends with another guy I made the exhibition rounds with, who invited us both to his birthday party. And he is German. I just left out the part about being in love with him. I can't admit that to anybody yet, that it's not a phase or experimentation or distraction from pressure. Nani was right. My stomach does flips when Chris calls or texts me, every single time. And when I'm with him, I feel like a real person, not the robot Keely called me, programmed to perform as expected. But Cooper and Chris only exists in the bubble of his apartment. Moving it anyplace else scares the hell out of me. For one thing, it's hard enough making it in baseball when you're a regular guy. The number of openly gay players who are part of a major league team stands at exactly one, and he's still in the minors. For another thing, Pop. My whole brain seizes when I imagine his reaction. He's the kind of good old boy who calls gay people fags and thinks we spend all our time hitting on straight guys. The one time we saw a news story about the gay baseball player, he snorted in disgust and said, "Normal guys shouldn't have to deal with that crap in the locker room." If I tell him about Chris and me, 17 years of being the perfect son would be gone in an instant. He'd never look at me the same. The way he's looking at me now, even though I'm a murder suspect who's been accused of using steroids. That he can handle. "Testing tomorrow," he reminds me. I have to get tested for steroids every damn week now. In the meantime, I keep pitching. And no, my fastball hasn't gotten any slower, because I haven't been lying. I didn't cheat. I strategically improved. It was Pop's idea. He wanted me to hold back a little junior year, not give my all, so there'd be more excitement around me during showcase season. And there was. People like Josh Langley noticed me. But now, of course, it looks suspicious. Thanks, Pop. At least he feels guilty about it. I was sure when the police got ready to show me the unpublished About That posts last month that I was going to read something about Chris and me. I'd barely known Simon, only talked with him one-on-one a few times. But any time I got near him, I'd worry about him learning my secret. Last spring at junior prom, he'd been drunk off his ass, and when I ran into him in the bathroom, he flung an arm around me and pulled me so close I practically had a panic attack. I was sure that Simon, who'd never had a girlfriend as far as I knew, realized I was gay and was putting the moves on me. I freaked out so bad, I had Vanessa disinvite him to her after-prom party. And Vanessa, who never passes up a chance to exclude somebody, was happy to do it. I let it stand even after I saw Simon hitting on Keeley later with the kind of intensity you can't fake. I hadn't let myself think about that since Simon died. Or the last time I'd talked to him, I acted like a jerk because I couldn't deal with who I was. And the worst part is, even after all this, I still can't.
Nate, Tuesday, October 16th, 6 p.m. When I get to Glenn's diner half an hour after I'm supposed to meet my mother, her Kia is parked right out front. Score one for the new and improved version, I guess. I wouldn't have been at all surprised if she didn't show. I thought about doing the same. A lot. But pretending she doesn't exist hasn't worked out all that well. I park my bike a few spaces away from her car, feeling the first drops of rain hit my shoulders before I enter the restaurant. The hostess looks up with a polite, quizzical expression. "I'm meeting somebody. Macaulay," I say. She nods and points to a corner booth. "Right over there." I can tell my mother's already been there for a while. Her soda's almost empty, and she's torn her straw wrapper to shreds. When I slide into the seat across from her, I pick up a menu and scan it carefully to avoid her eyes. "You order?" "Oh, no. I was waiting for you." I can practically feel her willing me to look up. I wish I weren't here. "Do you want a hamburger, Nathaniel? You used to love Glenn's hamburgers." I did, and I do. But now I want to order anything else. "It's Nate, okay?" I snap my menu shut and stare at the gray drizzle pelting the window. Nobody calls me that anymore. "Nate," she says. But my name sounds strange coming from her. One of those words you say over and over until it loses meaning. A waitress comes by and I order a Coke and a club sandwich I don't want. My burner phone buzzes in my pocket, and I pull it out to a text from Bronwyn. "Hope it's going okay." I feel a jolt of warmth, but put the phone back without answering. I don't have the words to tell Bronwyn what it's like to have lunch with a ghost. "Nate." My mother clears her throat around my name. It still sounds wrong. How are you doing in school? Do you still like science?" "Christ. Do you still like science?" I've been in remedial classes since ninth grade, but how would she know? Progress reports come home, I fake my father's signature, and they go back. Nobody ever questions them. "Can you pay for this?" I ask, gesturing around the table. Like the belligerent asshole I've turned into in the past 5 minutes. "Because I can't. So if you're expecting that, you should tell me before the food comes." Her face sags, and I feel a pointless stab of triumph. "Nate. I would never... Well, why should you believe me?" She pulls out a wallet and puts a couple of 20s on the table, and I feel like shit until I think about the bills I keep tossing into the trash instead of paying. Now that I'm not earning anything, my father's disability check barely covers the mortgage, utilities, and his alcohol. How do you have money when you've been in rehab for months? The waitress returns with a glass of Coke for me, and my mother waits until she leaves to answer. One of the doctors at Pine Valley, that's the facility I've been in, connected me with a medical transcription company. I can work anywhere, and it's very steady. She brushes her hand against mine, and I jerk away. I can help you and your father out, Nate. I will. I wanted to ask you if you have a lawyer for the investigation. We could look into that. Somehow I manage not to laugh. Whatever she's making, it's not enough to pay a lawyer. I'm good. She keeps trying, asking about school, Simon, probation, my dad. It almost gets to me, because she's different than I remember. Calmer and more even-tempered. But then she asks,
how's Bronwyn handling all this?
Nope. Every time I think about Bronwyn, my body reacts like I'm back on the couch in her media room. Heart pounding, blood rushing, skin tingling. I'm not about to turn the one good thing that's come out of this mess into yet another awkward conversation with my mother. Which means we've pretty much run out of things to say. Thank God the food's arrived so we can stop trying to pretend the last 3 years never happened. Even though my sandwich tastes like nothing, like dust, it's better than that. My mother doesn't take the hint. She keeps bringing up Oregon and her doctors, and Mikhail Powers investigates until I feel as if I'm about to choke. I pull at the neck of my t-shirt like that'll help me breathe, but it doesn't. I can't sit here listening to her promises and hoping it'll all work out. That she'll stay sober, stay employed, stay sane. Just stay. I have to go, I say abruptly, dropping my half-eaten sandwich onto my plate. I get up, banging my knee against the edge of the table so hard I wince, and walk out without looking at her. I know she won't come after me. That's not how she operates. When I get outside, I'm confused at first because I can't see my bike. It's wedged between a couple of huge Range Rovers that weren't there before. I make my way toward it, then suddenly a guy who's way overdressed for Glenn's Diner steps in front of me with a blinding smile. I recognize him right away, but look through him as if I don't. Nate McCauley? Mikhail Powers. You're a hard man to find, you know that? Thrilled to make your acquaintance. We're working on our follow-up broadcast to the Simon Kelleher investigation, and I'd love your take. How about I buy you a coffee inside and we talk for a few minutes? I climb onto my bike and strap on my helmet like I didn't hear him. I get ready to back up, but a couple of producer types block my way. How about you tell your people to move? His smile's as wide as ever. I'm not your enemy, Nate. The court of public opinion matters in a case like this. What do you say we get them on your side? My mother appears in the parking lot, her mouth falling open when she sees who's next to me. I slowly reverse my bike until the people in my way move and I've got a clear path. If she wants to help me, she can talk to him.
Chapter 21. Bronwyn. Wednesday, October 17th, 12:25 p.m. At lunch on Wednesday, Addie and I are talking about nail polish. She's a font of information on the subject. With short nails like yours, you want something pale, almost nude, she says, examining my hands with a professional air, but like super glossy.
I don't really wear nail polish, I tell her. Well, you're getting fancier, aren't you?